This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. This hour, we'll look back at one of the most provocative Supreme Court terms in history, from a far-reaching decision on the right to sexual privacy for gays to upholding the use of affirmative action in university and college admissions. The court took on some of the most contentious social issues of our times. Some view the court's decisions as a legal affirmation of an existing social consensus on these issues, but Justice Antonin Scalia scathingly described the court of having taken sides in the culture war. The high-profile rulings on social issues overshadowed other important decisions from the session, decisions on three strikes and internet filters at libraries, for example. Today, NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us to review this momentous court session and to look toward the court's future. Join the conversation. Do any of the Supreme Court's decisions affect your life? Do you have questions about one of this session's rulings, big or small? Did the court's justices surprise you this session? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now in Studio 3A is Nina Totenberg. Nina, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Nina, overall, how do you assess the significance of the court session that has just ended?
Well, it was a pretty momentous term. Now, there have been many others in recent years. We think of this as an astonishing term, but just think back a few years ago when we had the Paula Jones case on whether a president could have deferred immunity when he was being sued. We had the Right to Die case. It's always the most recent term that seems the most momentous. Nonetheless, the court did seem to want to get a couple of big issues behind it, namely affirmative action and the whole question of state anti-sodomy laws, which it had ruled on 17 years ago in a case called Bowers versus Hardwick.
Yeah. Well, were you surprised by the court's actions, the court's decisions in these cases?
I was not at all surprised by the sodomy case, because the minute the court accepted that case for review, and this was a test of a Texas law that made consenting homosexual conduct between two adults made it a crime, the minute it accepted that case for review, the only reason it was doing that was to invalidate that law in some fashion. It had said 17 years ago that those laws are constitutional. Hmm. So clearly, it was only accepting this case because a significant number of justices, a majority of the justices, was ready to take a fresh look at this whole issue in one way or another. On the affirmative action front, you have to understand the psyche of a reporter covering the Supreme Court by the end of the term, when they have shoved almost all the most important cases to the end of the term, and you are looking at the rather monumental task of explaining huge numbers of very important decisions in a very short period of time. I always start to think of the worst possible scenario. And for me, the worst possible scenario is a non-decision decision, mm-hmm. a decision that's very hard to explain because it slices the salami so thin. So mm-hmm. I had completely convinced myself that in the Michigan affirmative action cases, the court would say some variation of, yes, you can have affirmative action, but these particular programs weren't permissible. And I was then going to have to explain what schools were likely to do and what this really meant, mm-hmm. what the practical significance was. And instead, five members of the court very clearly said race can be a factor in college and university admissions, went back to the standard enunciated by Justice Powell 25 years ago that most colleges and universities have been following since then, and stuck with, for want of a better expression, the tried and true that the educational establishment, the military establishment, the business establishment, even the labor establishment was urging upon the court.
And what about this idea that what the court did in that case, and I think also in the sodomy case, is to essentially legalize what has already been sort of agreed upon by social consensus? Is that how people are describing it? And is that unusual for the court to go in that direction?
Well, Justice O'Connor recently published a series of legal essays in which she said Not exactly that. What she said was, the court very rarely takes a step on which there isn't some degree of social consensus. In other words, it doesn't go way out on a limb all by itself. Yes, Brown versus the Board of Education was a big step, but for most of the country, not the Deep South, but for most of the country, there was a consensus that schools should not be segregated by race. Even on the question of abortion, there certainly are lots of people who disagree with Roe versus Wade and disagree with the whole notion of abortion, think it's murder. But if you look at the public opinion polls, there is some sort of a consensus on that. At the same time, you have to say that the function of courts is, to some extent, when they're talking about individual rights and individual liberties, to stand up for those individual rights in the face of majoritarian rule or majoritarian desire to have a certain specific result. And to some extent, that's what the court did in the anti-sodomy laws case. It said, in those states where you have said that this conduct is a criminal act, we are overruling the majority decision of those states.
I wanted to ask you about the remark that Justice Antonin Scalia made, saying that the court has come down on one side of the culture wars, has made it. I mean, isn't that what the court inevitably was going to have to do on these issues? Isn't that partially the role of the court?
Well, it inevitably, when de Tocqueville once said that every major question that faces a country, or in this case the United States, will eventually end up in the United States at the Supreme Court. And so inevitably, when you take sides, inevitably you are taking sides. I have to say that although Justice Scalia's dissent has gotten a lot of public attention, and he spoke his dissent from the bench, which is an unusual step, it's the second time he's done that in a gay rights case. And I had the feeling in this one that, believe it or not, he had toned it down somewhat, that he was, for him, sort of going through the motions. He certainly knew what all of us knew, that he was going to lose, his position was going to lose in this case. So he's known that all year long since they agreed to hear the case. Mm. And, you know, in his last gay rights dissent, he called it the culture Kampf, and sort of a reference almost to Mein Kampf and Nazi kinds of language. In this one, he called it the culture war. So it came down a peg. It was certainly noteworthy, and it certainly represented his view and a substantial number of other people's views. But I thought it really came down a peg.
Now Sandra Day O'Connor has been criticized for changing her mind on a couple of issues, but particularly on the issue of the anti-sodomy laws. First of all, is that unusual for a Supreme Court justice to change his or her mind?
First of all, it's not unusual. It does happen. It's rare, but it does happen. And she would and did say in her concurring opinion that she had not changed her mind on the question that was presented in the first gay rights case, Bowers versus Hardwick. And that is whether states could criminalize certain sexual conduct both for heterosexuals and homosexuals. And that what she said in that case and what the court said in that case, she said, was that it could, if it had some rational basis for making that judgment. In this case, she said her judgment was different because the state of Texas was treating homosexuals differently than it was treating heterosexuals, so that activity that was perfectly legal for heterosexuals was illegal for homosexuals. And on that question, she said it was clear that the Constitution's guarantee to equal protection of the law didn't tolerate that. In the last analysis, it may be a distinction without a difference. After all, if you take this one step further and eliminate for the sake of argument the whole question of national security, what do you say about don't ask, don't tell? It certainly is. We wouldn't say that for the sexual practice. There isn't a military rule that says don't ask, don't tell about heterosexual conduct, no matter what it is, including, I suppose, whips and chains. But there is that rule for homosexual conduct. So I'm not sure that it's, I think to some extent it's a distinction without a difference.
We're discussing the recent Supreme Court session with NPR's Nina Totenberg. The number is 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the discussion. And let's take a call from Mark in Oklahoma City. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, I need to make use of Ms. Totenberg's expertise and memory about the Supreme Court. I'm trying to remember if Sandra Day O'Connor was on the court in Bowers versus Hardwick back
in
1986.
Was. She was. And she had been on the court for, I think, almost 4 years.
And how did she rule in Bowers versus Hardwick? Was she with
She was with the majority. And what she said, as I just indicated, what she said at the end of this term was that the question in that case was whether you could outlaw certain sexual conduct for everyone. The question in this case was whether you could outlaw it for homosexuals alone. And so that therefore, her judgment was different.
Well, I've once again heard the old rallying cry that especially this sodomy decision has resuscitated the specter of judicial activists versus strict instructionists. And I was wondering if you could cite some other decisions that would more muddy the water as far as what really constitutes judicial activism versus strict instructionists. I'm thinking that if the Republicans on the court in a highly contested presidential election side with the Republican president, then in essence give him the election. You can't get any more activist than that, but maybe that's just me.
I'd just like to point out to you that 7 of the members of the current court are Republican appointees, not 4. Not 5, but 7. There are only 2 Democratic appointees. So there were, in fact, 2 Republican appointees who voted against President Bush, then Governor Bush, in Bush versus Gore.
Does that answer your question, Mark?
Well, I still want further clarification about other decisions that would
look
work. Because it kind of seems like the judicial activists versus strict instructionists is in the eye of the beholder. For example, in this current sodomy decision, as I understand it, I haven't read it yet, but I understand that Justice Thomas says that he finds nothing in the Constitution that guarantees a right of privacy or words of that effect. And as a layman, when I look at the Ninth Amendment in the Bill of Rights, it seems pretty clear that it's right there.
Well, you've just synthesized what some of the disagreement on the court is, and certainly one person's judicial activist is another's faithful interpreter. And you could see that, you know, in the years of the Warren Court, conservatives said that it was a runaway liberal activist court. And now there are many Democrats who say that this court has on occasion been a runaway activist conservative court, overturning the judgments of Congress on a number of important questions.
You know, just before we go to the break, briefly, I wanted to get into the role that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor played in this last session. It was a really critical role. We can talk about it a little further after, but if you could just begin by explaining that to us.
Well, Justice O'Connor was in the majority in every 5-4 case decided this term, meaning that in every case, 5-4 case decided this term, you couldn't win without her. And that tells you how pivotal she was and why so many people are talking, at least this term, about this being as much the O'Connor Court as the Rehnquist Court.
All right, we're going to continue our discussion with NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg when we come back. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and you can send an email to totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the Supreme Court's recent session with NPR legal analyst Nina Totenberg. Nina, just before the break, we got into discussing the role that Sandra Day O'Connor played on the court. Is it surprising how dominant she became on this court?
Well, yes and no. I mean, she's she's one of the two, quote, swing justices. So she and Justice Kennedy. And so over the years, as the court has been more and more closely divided, 4-4 in general, with four more conservative members on one side, four more liberal members on the other side, with various gradations, they have been, the way they swing tends to be the way the case is decided. Now, one has to say that they are more conservative normally than they are liberal. But in these two important cases, affirmative action and the sodomy law case, in the sodomy case written by Justice Kennedy, they both voted, in essence, to strike down the Texas law. And in the affirmative action case, which she wrote, she was the fifth and deciding vote. And so these are the cases that are the highest profile cases of the term. So that's the way it was.
All right, we're going to bring in some other guests now to continue our discussion on the Supreme Court. Chris Schrader is a professor of law at Duke University, and he's on the line with us from the campus in Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Lynn. It's great to be here.
And John Yu, a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, joins Nina and myself here in Studio 3A. Thanks for being with us, John.
No, thanks for having me.
Let me ask both of you the same question that I asked Nina at the beginning, and that is, what's your assessment? How would you characterize this latest session? John Yu?
I think this is a term where the court made clear that it's at least at the center of the court, that it's quite a liberal court, that they see their function, at least in the area of individual rights, of identifying a coalescing public consensus on things like abortion, affirmative action, and role of gays in society, and incorporating that directly into the Constitution, and by doing that, setting a national standard for social questions that divide a lot of Americans.
Chris Schrader, what's your take?
Well, I think this term demonstrates that this court is still basically a conservative court. It's not as conservative as some conservatives would like it to be. But I think part of the reason for that is that there are at least two kinds of conservatism that sometimes get lumped together, but I think this term demonstrates how they need to be distinguished. I think there's ideological conservatism, which is a commitment to a set of principles that need to be applied whenever the occasion arises. And there's a kind of dispositional conservatism that's reluctant to change the status quo, or at least needs very good reasons to do that. And I think Sandra Day O'Connor tends to be a practical dispositional conservative. And it's not surprising that on the two decisions that the court faced this term, in which there was an issue of major social consequence as to which there had been some degree of cultural settlement or compromise, that she sided with the compromise.
And of course, we've been focusing a lot on those two decisions, the decisions on affirmative action and on the right to privacy in sexual behavior, the sodomy question. But what are some of the other decisions that we should be looking at that would, for example, illustrate the conservative nature of this course, that you think the court is actually conservative? Chris Schrader, where can we look to see that in some of the other decisions?
Well, this is still a court that's very hard on criminal defendants and prisoners' rights, notwithstanding the case they decided the last day in which they upheld a challenge on the grounds of inadequate counsel and set aside a criminal conviction. They decided the three strikes cases out of California in the face of some very, very strenuous and many people thought grossly disproportionate sentences in favor of upholding those laws. And it's very difficult to win a criminal defendant's rights case in this court. And I think that may well be the legacy of an effort from President Nixon forward that distinguishes conservatives and liberals on this court.
John Yu?
Well, I think I disagree a little bit with Chris on that point, in the sense that I agree that the court is not as sympathetic to the rights of criminal defendants as it had been under the Warren Court period. However, that's a consensus that both liberals and conservatives in the political sphere have shared. I think Justices Ginsburg and Breyer often vote with the other justices to restrict what had once been overly expansive criminal rights. I think the real question about why it's not a conservative court, in my view, is that this is not a court that's deciding questions narrowly. If you look at both the affirmative action case and the Texas versus Lawrence case, the court pretty much settled those questions in a very permanent way, in a way that really can't be changed by the political process. In the affirmative action case, the court identified a safe harbor for every university to engage in affirmative action. Of course, in Texas, states are no longer free to engage in the regulation of, I don't think, in sexual activity going forward, and maybe morals legislation generally as we go forward.
Well, John, don't you think that that states are still free, for example, through the referendum process, if they want, to ban the consideration of race in state college admissions? That this won't go to private colleges as well, which this case that was before the court, had the court gone the other way, it would have affected every private institution in the country as well, because they all get federal money, so they would have been affected. But today, Ward Connerly, who was responsible for Proposition 209 in California, which bans the consideration of race in California, announced that they're going to try to do the same thing in Michigan. And so the political process is still free, isn't it, to do what it will with that issue?
Yeah, I quite agree with that. I think the Grutter case, the best thing for anti-preference folks that comes out of it is that returns it, I think, at some level to the states, although before Grutter, you could have said there was still a diversity, if you will, of political positions on affirmative action growing throughout the country. You had the Fifth Circuit in California, the Ninth Circuit, Texas, with anti-preferences. You had other parts of the country where that was not the case, you know, New England, the Mid-Atlantic states. But I do agree with you, now if you're against preferences, you're going to have to go and do the expensive thing of waging state-by-state campaigns.
I do want to say one thing about these two cases that I thought was really interesting, and that is, in the last analysis, now that I've had a good week to think about it, I think the court settled them, as John said, but it settled them very clearly, because if it didn't, they were going to keep coming back. It didn't slice the salami thin, as it frequently does, because it's had a long time to think about them. There were at least five, and in the case of the sodomy case, six members of the court who knew pretty much what they thought, and that's a clear majority. In one case, a narrower majority than the other. And they just, I don't think they wanted to deal with this case, these again. I mean,
we're talking now about the affirmative action case
and the sodomy case. They've been floating around these issues. They keep getting litigated in the lower courts, as John just alluded to. They wanted them off their back.
And they're not going to, there's no way they'll come back for, is there any room for them to return anytime soon?
There's always room for them to return, but I don't really, tell me, John or Chris, do you think I'm wrong? I don't see them coming back.
I agree. In fact, I think what's happened is a significant shift in momentum in how these issues are going to be treated. Now, I think in the future, people who want to extend affirmative action outside the universities to the military, government hiring, because of the broad language in Grutter, that's where the momentum is going to be. Before this decision, the momentum had been on the side of people trying to challenge preferences in all different kinds of ways throughout the country. I think the same is with Texas versus Lawrence. You'll see the cause of gay rights being applied in other areas, marriage, gays in the military, and so on, whereas before, the momentum had probably been the other way, or at least had not been going in favor of either camp.
And the other thing one has to say is that about the sodomy case, that case, when it was decided in 1986, almost instantly became an outlier. It hasn't been cited in any Supreme Court majority opinion since then. It's almost as if it was the last gasp of a previous cultural era. And even when, in, for example, the Boy Scouts case, when the Boy Scouts won and the gay rights activists lost, and Chief Justice Rehnquist, I think, wrote the opinion, one of you two guys will correct me if I'm wrong, he wrote it, and he was a dissenter in the Lawrence case from Texas last week, but he wrote the Boy Scouts case in a way with great respect for people who are gay, which was not true in Bowers versus Hardwick. It was Bowers versus Hardwick. You would have to be blind not to admit that it was a homophobic decision. It had that kind of language in it, the kind of language that isn't acceptable in America today.
I want to take some calls, but before we do, I just want to move the discussion to another issue which the court dealt with in a number of decisions in this session, and that is free speech, which is another issue where you can sometimes see the cultural fault lines, the cultural wars acting out. Well, the most recent ruling was that libraries that get federal money have to place anti-pornography filters on their computers to protect children. Nina, maybe you can just talk about that case or some of the other free speech cases that...
I'll let Chris do that. Okay. Chris, you take this one.
Well, the library case is a very interesting case. I think in some respects, in general, this court has been about as protective of free speech interests as any court I can recall. In this case, of course, they sided with a federal statute that withholds federal funds from libraries unless they put internet filters on their desktop computers that have internet access. And in one way, the court was the case for some of the justices was a test of a couple of principles that may be in some tension here. There's a good group of justices on the court that think when the government is using its dollars and cents to fund programs, it has a great deal of latitude in controlling what the content of the speech that comes out of those programs can be, going back to some very significant regulations having to do with what family counselors could say with respect to abortion. And in this case, an analogous issue came up. What's the scope of the government's authority when it is paying for part of the program, and when the penalty that to be applied if you don't decide to go along is simply the withdrawal of those funds? The court sided with a fairly expansive reach of government authority in this case.
John, did you want to add to that in any way?
No, I think on the First Amendment case, the libertarians really got kind of bushwhacked this term. They lost in both the cyber porn and the campaign finance cases. A pure libertarian view, which is just no government regulation of speech and any form, really lost out this term.
And cross-burning. Don't forget cross-burning.
And cross-burning, too. That's right. I don't know if that signals any kind of shift from the court's general, very protective approach towards free speech, but this term it was definitely a setback.
All right. If you'd like to join our discussion on the Supreme Court session, the number's 1-800-989-8255, and let's take a call now from Malcolm in Memphis, Tennessee. Hi, Malcolm.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, go ahead.
My question was about the possible appointment of new justices to the court, perhaps during this or the next Bush term, should he get reelected. And I had heard a historian say that as society, the pendulum of society swings between conservatism and liberalism, the Supreme Court is actually 20 years behind the current thinking in the society because it takes so long to get a justice onto the court and then perhaps replace that person. And I was wondering if Nina and your guests could commentate on where the court is vis-a-vis our current societal thinking and where it might go with any potential new justice appointment.
All right. Thanks for your call, Malcolm. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Nina?
I actually don't think that the whole liberal-conservative shtick works very well, and that analysis works very well. What I think is true is that the issues are different now than they will be 20 years from now. Who would have forecast, for example, 20 years ago, that questions of national security and how far the government could go in detaining an American citizen, those are all questions that are headed to the Supreme Court. I don't think any one of us would have forecast that was likely to be the issue in front of this court. And so I think the issues are different. And in the New Deal era, they were all a question of whether the court would uphold what Congress and the president did to remedy the fault lines, as it were, of the Great Depression. And those same justices who were liberal on those questions, quote, liberal, that is, they sided with upholding, today we might call it conservative, to say you're upholding congressional and executive power. Some of them were quite conservative on questions of individual rights. So I think that's a better way to look at it.
All right, let's go to another caller, Roger in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Roger.
Well, good afternoon. I've tried to follow Ms. Totenberg's analysis over the years on the NPR. And I wanted to ask about the Lawrence case. It seems to me that contrary to what, one individual suggested that the Lawrence case, since it overturned precedent, meant that Roe was in some kind of danger. I think it's to the contrary, since the Lawrence case now is the third case in a line of precedent, the Griswold, Roe, and Lawrence v. Texas, that upholds the right of privacy as found in the Ninth Amendment. And I was just wondering what you thought about that.
I think you're right. I mean, there's just no way of looking at this except as underlining what the court had previously said was a right to privacy.
Yeah, it seems to me that barring a real change in the court, that not only is Roe there, but even more importantly, we now have a line of precedent that upholds privacy, which I think is a very good thing.
Of course, your caveat is a significant one. Depending on whether there are any changes in the court. My personal view is it's unlikely that there are going to be any before the election. But after the election, if President Bush is reelected, for example, I would assume he'll have three appointments, at least.
Well, I would assume Rehnquist and O'Connor, and who would be the third?
Stevens. Well, Stevens is 83 right now.
That's the one we can't lose. That one, and we can't lose the O'Connor one. I think Rehnquist, you could make a trade myself. That's just my opinion.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Roger.
Yeah, have a good day.
All right. Well, of course, he brings up the fact that we didn't have any retirements as expected.
No, we didn't, and just in case we all missed that fact, Justice O'Connor said on Sunday that she wasn't retiring this term.
Was that unusual for Justice O'Connor to appear on the TV shows as she did?
Well, she was on one, really, and it was in connection with the dedication of the new Constitution Center, and she appeared with Justice Breyer, and they talked about essentially how the court works. It wasn't what you'd call your typical newsmaking, you know, say, Justice O'Connor, tell us what you really thought. Forget that. You don't do that with Supreme Court justices.
And just, Nina, and I guess all of you, you've been covering the court for years. Does it always manage to surprise you?
It often surprises me. Less, I have to say, these days than when I first started covering the court. This is a much more active court in questioning people, and the justices give away more, betray more of their views in their questions. That may be a result of, you know, some of the more liberal members of the court answering some of the more conservative members of the court who, in their questioning, but I used to really not know how cases are going to turn out. Now, most cases, I have some idea.
Well, thanks for joining us, NPR's Nina Totenberg. And thanks also to John Yoo. He's a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And also Chris Schrader, a professor of law at Duke University. He joined us from their studios in Durham, North Carolina. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.